You're listening to the Makers and Mystics podcast. This is season 13, episode 13, the season finale. Joining me for today's roundtable discussion is the founder of Ecstasis Magazine, Connor Sweetman, and essayist Yining Chu. Alongside of Ecstasis, Connor serves as the Director of Innovation for Christianity Today, while Yining writes Please Don't Go, a newsletter about life in community, why it's terrible, why it's essential, and why we shouldn't give up on cultivating it. I'm your host, Stephen Roach, and in today's episode, we discuss expressive individualism, various frameworks of community, and why physical community remains essential in our modern digitized culture. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to everyone who contributed to our recent fundraiser. You can visit patreon.com/makersandmystics for an exciting and detailed update. As most of our listeners know, this season on the podcast, we have been talking about community and culture. And every season on the podcast, we do a roundtable where it's just a loose conversation around this theme. We just kind of tie up the threads. And that's what I wanted to do today, is to talk with both of you about community and culture as it impacts the life of the artist. And I'd love to start just by diving into the conversation. Yining, I know that on your Substack, you recently were talking about community and talking about the physicality of community and even limiting yourself to a physical community, which in the modern day seems to be almost a countercultural approach to community, where we all are living in this digital, almost disembodied world, if you will. Why don't we just dive into that and talk to me about why physical community is such an important part of life?
Yeah, well, thanks for that great question. I'll start by saying that I don't think I'm naturally inclined to want to stay within a certain physical community. And I think a lot of that has to do with how I have been very formed by my dominant culture, whether that's the San Francisco Bay Area, where there is a lot of transience, where people are pursuing careers or education or, you know, like moving on to the next thing, or even just wanting to travel. There's a lot of a desire to not be constrained by the physical environment that you've been given. And I think in addition to that, I feel like I have, in a lot of my adulthood, embraced a strain of Christianity that's been about transcending the world that's been given to you, which in some ways has sounded good. But I think through my 20s and now like I'm into my 30s, like I've been reading just a lot about how Jesus is so interesting and how he chooses to constrain himself to a group of people within a geographical region and to not reach for any of the things that could possibly expand the options that are available to him. And he doesn't do this out of a sense of like his own limitation or like even a sense of being willingly victimized by his surroundings. But I think he does it out of a desire to show a kind of commitment to the world that's been given to him in a way that we can imitate. And so for me, what that has meant is I feel like I have honestly struggled a lot with not wanting to stay where I'm at for many reasons, like, you know, whether it's just like how expensive the San Francisco Bay Area is, or even the kinds of tensions that have erupted in the area. For example, like my family, intergenerational family, Asian American here, and even the anti-Asian violence that has kind of erupted in many big cities has made me and my family think twice, like, should we be here? Is this unwise? And those are all valid questions to think about, right? Like financial hardship or circumstances of other kinds. But what I've come back to is I do think that there's something in the gospel that invites people to see the world that's been given to them as a way to have communion with Jesus by choosing to look at the people and the places that have been given to us as something to steward and to cultivate with love and not something to transcend or escape.
Yes. Wow, that's beautiful. It's almost like the limitation allows you to go to an even deeper, richer level. I think we can only take in so much as human beings. And when we just try to continue to take in more and more and more, on some level, it has to dilute the depth that you can actually both give and receive from that, would you say?
Yeah, I think it dilutes the depth. And I also think it just occludes our vision of Christ. And I think these two things go together. I think, as a kid, my favorite psalm was one that says, "This is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it." And I just think about, if I take that for what it's worth, if I truly believe that, creation is made good, that it's meant to be a reflection of who God is, if I believe in the Imago Dei, that every human being is made in the image of Christ, I rob myself of the ability to see that if I remove myself from an environment the minute something gets ugly or uncomfortable. And so I think, to what you said about depth, exactly, right? Like if I leave before I get to the other side of the discomfort or the pain, what if I miss the opportunity to see the face of Christ in my neighbor or in my neighborhood?
Yeah, I'm thinking through the way that's such a powerful dichotomy between kind of constraining yourself for the sake of the community and for the sake of sacrificing for their benefit, as opposed to individualizing all your work for the sake of you. And what I'm thinking of, and Yi Ning is really bringing this to mind, is as someone who recently moved from Canada over to the UK earlier this year, working remotely, I'm in this world where my full-time job is working for a literary magazine, creating artistic community, cultivating creative economy even. Meanwhile, my wife works we live 30 minutes outside London, a small little church of 150 people. 50 of those people are children, and that's why my wife is a children pastor there. So essentially, I'm just seeing this real dichotomy and a very almost pleasant dichotomy emerge where I am individualizing myself in my work that is benefiting the wider internet community, but they don't need me to actually participate that much in the wider creative community because obviously I hope that what I do is valuable, but what it really means is on a Sunday, on a Wednesday, at Life Group, at Alpha Course, my presence is genuinely needed in order to keep it going, in order to, and I'm not necessary to it, but my presence is way more beneficial to the overall vibe, the overall conversation and communication, and basically just creating an atmosphere where people can feel seen and known and genuinely have that deeper connection that brings a deep sense of well-being and anti-loneliness. Meanwhile, in my daytime job on the internet, I'm really kind of mixing my metaphors here, but I want to contribute to the well-being of the wider community. But it's so much about myself and what I'm doing. And I'm just seeing a contrast in what Yi Ning is saying and what my own life is looking like, the shape of it. It has to have a balance of the in-person self-sacrifice for the sake of the constrained community, as opposed to, and you can still have, and this is where I think some of this conversation can get derailed a little bit, because I still have a lot of ambition. I have a lot of hope to make a wider impact, a wider influence, but you have to recognize that that only goes so far, and there's no actual end in sight with that, and you can start to kind of spin yourself in circles of trying to reach an end that can never be accomplished in that disembodied realm of digital community. Meanwhile, in the church community, in your local life, there's no end in sight in the same way. And so you can actually contribute just to the well-being of the culture, just showing up, bringing meals, talking with people. That is what it's all about. And that's actually what brings life to your soul in the Imago Dei. So it's kind of the either and situation that I'm starting to see can live in unity, but you have to recognize that they can't fulfill each other, essentially.
Several thoughts come to mind in what you're saying. And One is, you know, we have this dichotomy between individualism and belonging. There's the individual life, and then there is the life of the community. And in our modern day culture, it seems that the mindset of expressive individualism has become the predominant mindset of culture. And I think what that does in many ways is that it postures us to where we approach community based on what we can gain from that community rather than what we give to that community. And I think it's interesting, you know, Connor, because you said, you know, I have ambition. I want to have a greater impact, you know, but I think the way that we approach that as a follower of Jesus would be very different than maybe the way that the wider culture would, you know, tell us to arrive there. For instance, you know, Jesus talked about the way we arrive at greatness is by serving. So he never said that greatness was wrong to desire. That's built into us. We know that as individuals and as a part of a community, we're built to have impact in the world. But in talking about this countercultural approach of constraining ourselves in order to serve a local physical community, it's a revolutionary idea that flies in the face of the modern day expressive individualism, you know? And I've thought a lot, and people have heard me talk about it here on the podcast a lot as well, that there's a big difference between individualism and individuality. And I think individualism begins and ends with the self, whereas individuality, it kind of speaks of a posture of wholeness for the sake of bettering the community at large. And so I think that as we talk about kind of a mindset of consumerism versus a mindset of servanthood, I think these are important questions that this conversation is bringing to light. What do you think, Yining?
I really like the dichotomy that you just gave between individuality versus individualism. So I just wrote that down for myself. I'm going to think about that a little more. Yeah, thanks for that, Stephen. I think what you said about how there's a difference in the beginning and the end point, even though sometimes like the middle portions of those journeys can even look identical or similar, but like the beginning motivator and the end goal between these two frameworks are very different. And what immediately came to mind as you said that was Caitlin Beatty's book, Celebrities for Jesus, where she talks about the distinction, right, between fame versus influence. Is that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's the way that she sets it up, right? Where she was like, if you are famous, you are building a platform for the sake of attracting people to yourself and your brand, and the end goal is self-enrichment. Whereas if you have influence, sometimes you can't help but have influence if you are actually doing something or providing something that ends up being of service to many people.
Yes.
And so I think the way she makes that distinction is so good. And then where that continues to go for me then is, and like Connor and I talked about this a lot last fall, about Jesus's own distinction between himself and the false prophets that he calls out in Matthew 7, where he talks about telling people to beware of false prophets because they are wolves in sheep's clothing and they're seeking to devour. Whereas for himself, he is a shepherd. And at the end of his earthly ministry, he lays down his physical body and even offers it to people as a meal through communion. And like, you cannot be more, you know, oppositional in terms of these attitudes towards people, right? It's like, if you're a false prophet, you may be doing whatever it is that Jesus is doing in the public sphere, but your end goal is to devour, right? Like, the end goal is purely extractive and you are aiming to add unto yourself. Whereas you could be doing something very similar, something that's public and provocative and it's attracting an audience, but the end goal is to think about who you can enrich, right? And so I think, like, as someone who's writing right now, like the verse that always is just like in the back of my mind as kind of like a plumb line for evaluating everything I'm doing or aspiring to do is what Jesus says about himself, right? How he says he did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And so that's just always the question for me is like, is this endeavor going to serve? Is this going to enrich or nourish somebody towards the next step of where they need to be?
It makes me think a few episodes back, I did a live talk with Jess Ray and the community up in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I did a talk on the different mindsets of scarcity versus abundance. And I think that when we're talking about the difference between a shepherd and then a wolf who's seeking to devour, I mean, that devour just speaks of consumerism. It devouring speaks of taking something. And I was just sitting here thinking about when we have a mindset of scarcity, or when we have a mindset of poverty, then whoever we encounter, we have to take. We feel like we have to take something because we feel a lack within ourselves. But when we have a mindset of abundance, when we are at rest in the beloved, is the way that I say it often, then we can have a mindset of generosity. We can have one of giving because we know that the divine resource is flourishing. There's no end. And I think that that's why even talking about expressive individualism versus community and selflessness, it goes back to a mindset of, do I feel lack within myself, or do I feel that I have an abundance with which I can give?
Yeah, this might seem a little obscure, but this whole conversation is making me think of this debate I've been having in myself over the last couple of years of when I read 20th century writers like Milan Kundera, Susan Sontag, European kind of focused cultural critics that are so politically oriented, politically driven, I wonder to myself why, and very much non-Christian, why is there a kind of understanding today that we can't talk political without getting deep? Like, everything political has been flattened, and especially in America. And I say this as a non-American, but it just seems like it's just so flat, the landscape of debate and the landscape of dialogue. And then when I look at kind of the great world wars, World War I, World War II, and then Susan Sontag, she went to the Bosnian War. She went and kind of offered her body in a way to get, she could have gotten killed very easily over there. Milan Kundera, he's a Czech writer who was a part of the Prague Spring. And so I very much don't agree with their ideologies, but they're writing about politics in a way that is so flesh and blood human, in a way that offers their bodies for the sake of their cause. And I think there's actually something so admirable about that, that we have just learned in American Western evangelicalism and Christianity as a whole, and not even Christianity, culture as a whole, to just operate on such a level of plastic veneer that everything is for like self-enrichment, under like entrepreneurialism is the core of American Western culture, self-enrichment. So even very valid moral conquest is for the sake of my own personal enrichment. And then when you go back literally only like a century ago, 5 decades ago, there just was a different mentality that I think the internet has probably changed, because you can get very rich very quickly with very little effort. Whereas before, you kind of had to show up and be there and put your life on the line for the sake of the cause that you were kind of waving the flag for. And I know that's kind of a little bit of a different angle, but it's just so interesting, this idea of putting your life on the line, self-sacrifice, even in a non-Christian context, and how much that veneer has leaked in to both the Christian reality and the non-Christian reality.
I think it goes back to the inverted kingdom that Jesus puts forth in the gospel, you know, in the sense that seeking to save your life, you lose it, but seeking to give it away, you find it. And that's such a foreign concept to, again, the expressive individualism that I think is such a predominant part of modern culture. But one question I'd love to get your thoughts on, both of you, because Connor, you mentioned being involved in a local church community there, and Ening, I'm not sure of what that looks like in your life. I know for me, it's been a struggle for a very long time, and you know, I see value within the communities of faith. I see value in regular meeting together in these things. But I know that for so many people in our present day, that's a real challenge. And whether that is because of the way that we're meeting together, or that the substance of what happens when we meet together is missing the mark, whatever it is, I'd love to just hear your thoughts on how that part of community and culture is playing out in your lives in this time.
Oh, man. I think this is the subject that is probably the closest to my heart whenever I think about creativity, sacrificial living, and embodied community. I think we are at such an interesting point right now in Western spiritual life, because I think it's been almost a decade of seeming unbroken scandal when it comes to the Western church. And I don't think any part of the church has escaped unscathed. I think, you know, high church, low church, seminary, like outside of seminary, everyone has had some kind of heartbreak. And as far as like the corporate body of Christ is concerned, and the thing that I've been meditating on a lot is how one of the things that makes Christianity so radical is its doctrine of forgiveness, and how that is so central to our faith. And in Christ's defining act on earth, it is an act of radical forgiveness and conciliation, not even to people who were far away, but to the people who were closest to him, who abandoned him in his moment of need. And so I think in Christ's crucifixion and resurrection and act of conciliation towards the world, he addresses everything from religious superstructures, right? Whether it's through the Pharisees, to the government that unjustly tries and executes him, to the what you would call his like local spiritual community and his disciples and his friends who deny him. And he shows that he's leaving this mandate for forgiveness and conciliation to the people who want to claim to be his followers in the aftermath. And I say all these things because I think they are all so salient to people who want to come back to a church community or want to stay in a church community and who find it incredibly painful. To make it personal, I'll say that for myself, like the whole reason in the back of my head I started my Substack was because I had the opportunity to work with a local church that I loved so much in the capacity of a diversity and inclusion minister. And I think following the initial fervor for racial justice and reform in 2020, 2021, that role ended. And it was such a heartbreak for me and a disappointment for many people who were hoping to see massive change in the church. And walking away from that experience, I think two things. Number one is that the kind of brokenness and pain that exists in the church, and frankly, the unrepentance in the church, these are real and they have to be confronted. And there's no way to love the church and take the church seriously without placing a high moral demand on how the church behaves. Right. So that is absolutely true. Like if you love somebody, if you take them seriously, it is incumbent upon you to challenge them. At the same time, I think about what theologian Willie James Jennings says, and he talks about this concept of no critique without communion. Again, no critique without communion. So that's the thing I think about for people who are in pain and for people who see the real brokenness of the church, the real need for repentance and reformation. These things are undeniable. And at the same time, there's no way to do these things unless we copy what Jesus does, which is he places the call for reform on his people, and yet he embraces them in their moments of greatest depravity. And even as they are physically wounding him, right, he refuses to withdraw himself again from that embodied experience of being with them. And so when I think about the church, like, man, my heart just goes out to people who have been wounded or who feel just the frustration of trying to find a local community. Like, I really, really empathize and I grieve with these people. And I also think it's so crucial that we remember that the core of our faith is to turn to one another repeatedly in an imitation of Christ.
Well, I want to bring this around to one final question for us to consider. And all three of us are writers. Connor, you're running Ecstasis Magazine. Ining, you're doing some beautiful writing on your Substack and different articles for different publications. I want to bring this home to the role of the artist in culture creation and the role of the artist in community. And I know that especially with the vocation of writing, there is a lot of solitude that goes into that practice, but it's a solitude that has a conversation in mind. We write with the anticipation of a reader. And so historically, artists and creatives have been the culture shapers. You know, they have been the ones who lead movements that cause us to see life in a different way that can speak to a mass amount of people at one time and begin to consider other ideas. So I'd love to hear from you on how you see literature as an agent of shaping culture and why the community. I know these are kind of two big questions that can be independent of one another, but how community and culture work themselves out in the life of the artist.
Well, I would speak to this more as a reader right now. I think for myself, the work that I've been appreciating and really have been challenged and inspired by especially with what we're talking about right now with regards to embodied community, it's similar to what Connor said about who are the people who kind of put their bodies into the work that they're doing. And the thing that they produce on the other side of that interaction becomes so much more strange and unique and demanding even of the reader because of the process they went through. And so right now I'm actually thinking about nonfiction writers. I'm thinking about Arlie Russell Hochschild. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. So she's a sociologist who's probably best known for coining the term emotional labor in the 80s with her work on people who work in domestic settings. And then she also produced another book in 2015 called Strangers in Their Own Land, Fear and Mourning on the American Right. And that book was so remarkable to me because she is a Jewish progressive sociologist working at UC Berkeley, and she chooses to spend 5 years just kind of living alongside, going to church with, hanging out with people who are at that time fomenting the Tea Party, which is like the more right-wing, like a further right branch of conservatism in America. And I think you see in the book how opposed they are to one another and just their approach to life and the world. But she enters in with so much curiosity and rigor for herself and making sure that she is fully immersing herself in the lives and the minds of people who are not intuitive for her to understand. And on the other side, the book that she produces, where she's just narrating just kind of the emotional and the physical landscape of people that she personally, that she herself finds incomprehensible. I think that inspires and challenges me so much as someone who thinks that people who follow Jesus have a very high call to be embodied and to be creating something that is reflective of our grappling with a reality that is difficult, usually broken, and demands a kind of rigor in our response. And one thing that I often think about as it relates to creativity is how I think that as a Christian, for myself, speak for me, I think that there is a strong temptation to be prematurely conclusive in whatever I create.
Yes.
Right. And like, I think you all probably see that, especially because like, if you are someone who is like driven by like a creed, a set of beliefs, like you kind of know where you're supposed to land. And oftentimes the work that is produced in that mindset it's terrible. It's a waste of people's time. Nobody should be reading it, right? Because it's just like, it's obvious. And like the work behind it is minimal. But I think when I see people who will put themselves in the situations where they are least likely to have a prefabricated answer, where they're going to be the most forced to fight to make sense of what they're seeing, the work that they produce on the other end is so good. And then maybe for a work of fiction that I'll drop in here too to think about is Vincent Cunningham, who's the theater critic for The New Yorker. He just released his debut novel earlier this year called Great Expectations, a play on the Dickensian Great Expectations. And it's his work of autofiction. And I feel like it's an inspiring and a triggering work for almost everybody, because the premise is he's talking about grappling with the death of his father and the death of a pastor at a church that he was a part of and really formed by. And then going from those two periods of mourning into working for the first Obama campaign, and then coming up close to the idea that maybe all of the ideals and the sound bites and the slogans that you've associated with the different movements you've been a part of don't have the kind of depth and the ability to transform that you think they do. And so the entire book is just him kind of grappling with the attractions of the church that he was in, the attractions of this political campaign that he's now a part of, the death of his father, and thinking about how easy it would have been to form certain narratives around all of these figures, but being forced to walk through them instead to find another way to interpret them when you find that proximity and embodiment kind of scrambles the meaning of all these things. So I think, yeah, Vincent Cunningham and Arlie Russell Hochschild, they are really doing what I aspire to do as a creative when it comes to thinking about how art and culture can interact with one another.
Yeah, I love what you said, Yining, about sloganism, the destruction of sloganism. And I think that I've been thinking about that a lot. And I've, even as the editor of a magazine, but also kind of moving into some event spaces where we're doing similar to what you do, Stephen, with Breath in the Clay, just kind of a bringing together of people that have like-mindedness, but then being introduced to different mediums, different perspectives, and then actual well-thought-out storytelling initiatives. And so I hate to bring it back to it, but even the word ecstasis, and I'm thinking about this because of the fact that I might be moving away from the word ecstasis, so I'm really analyzing, okay, what does this actually mean? Ecstasis, okay, stasis is to be secure in one place. Ec is to be out of that. So ecstasis, to be outside of oneself, in a state of awe or wonder. And I think I used to think of ecstasis as being an aim toward the transcendent and an aim upward to God, obviously, but also even just the upward towards the emotional core of reality that finds its heart in God, but then can very much be used for light and dark means, as we see in art throughout. But more and more, I'm just thinking about, okay, not only ecstasis as an outside of oneself for the sake of like going towards God directly, but what does it mean to be outside of oneself even in the individualized writing that we're doing? So when you're writing a self, like a personal essay, how do we not curve back into ourselves at the end of every essay? How do we expand into a wider perspective of the world, of community, of divinity, of God? And again, I'm speaking from a very orthodox perspective. I don't want to get airy-fairy, but I think that the essay and literature and visual art for sure, but I'm specifically thinking about literature, can be a tool. And it unfortunately is, in the internet age, the personal essay has become so self-indulgent. And I have been thinking about how do we move beyond that, writing for the sake of our own gratification, going back to what we said in the beginning. How do we write for the sake of the community, but also for the sake of our history, for the sake of the rich heritage that we come from the sake of perspectives that we do not agree with at all, but there is gold in it. And it's like, oh, they are made in the Imago Dei. What are they seeing in that? How do I kind of see through that lens in a way that brings something of worth up to the core? So anyways, this is all very loosey-goosey, but I am interacting, I'm thinking about the interaction between the essay as a form and community gatherings. Like, what does it mean for an essay to be read in community and then spur people forward in their own lives to be thinking through a frame that's offered by someone else's individuality? So yeah, just thinking of how to create generativity through artistic community as opposed to self-gratification through the artistic practice.
Very well said. And I think this all goes back to what we did say at the beginning, when it goes back to where does it begin and what is the end point? And I think that community happens in the midst of that. And, you know, you talked about ecstasis. I love breaking down that word. And recently I've been thinking about eccentric, you know, which is a stereotype that many artists are pegged with as being eccentric, which means being removed from the center. And I made this statement recently because that tends to be the tension, is that artists can live on the fringe of community, whereas the stereotype of the churchgoer or the person of faith is to be very straight-laced and very centric, very central. And that tension between those two things tends to be where a lot of the discord happens. And I was thinking two thoughts. I wrote, in matters of faith, find yourself in the center of the beloved. In matters of art, lose yourself in the vast swell of the infinite. And I think that the word that ties all these things together, from an individuality and not an individualism, and what ties that together with more of an abundant mindset rather than a poverty mindset, one of serving and not of consumerism, the word integrity comes to mind for me. And I mean integrity in the original use of that word, which means all of the parts integrated together to serve the greater whole. Things are integrated for the purpose of wholeness. And so as we close up this season on the podcast of focusing on community and culture, that's the word I'd like to leave our listeners with, is integrity and wholeness, and that all things working together for the good. And I just want to say to Connor and Ining, I appreciate both of you as fellow artists and writers. I appreciate the work that you're doing, and I look forward to connecting with you both more in the future. So thank you so much for joining me on Makers and Mystics today.
Pleasure.
Thank you. This was so fun.
Thank you for listening to the Makers and Mystics podcast. This episode was produced by me, Stephen Roach, with music provided by Somewhere at Sea. See the show notes of this episode for links to today's guests. And if you've been inspired by this podcast, I want to invite you to help us continue producing the show by becoming a monthly patron. As a patron, you'll receive exclusive content as well as access to our various online community events. We'll see you again soon for season 14, and until then, keep creating. The world needs your art.